Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. As we approach the end of the year, the calendar for enacting major legislative packages is getting shorter, and this week, House Democrats indicated that their plans to hold a vote on the prescription drug plan would be put on hold until at least December. This week on the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, we look into the political and policy divides that are holding up these issues, as well as look to state reforms, the expanded health reimbursement arrangements, and how some want to pay for single-payer healthcare. Before we begin, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these platforms ahead of being distributed through NAHU's member-exclusive health policy newsletter, The Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. NAHU met with Trump administration officials this week to address our concerns with the implementation of the expanded rule on health reimbursement arrangements. What were some of the concerns we relayed, and what is the administration planning on this issue in the coming months?
We met specifically to talk about the expansion on the individual coverage HRAs, also affectionately called ICHRAs. And although we met with folks from CMS a number of weeks ago, this meeting was expanded to include folks from IRS and Treasury and the Department of Labor, all of whom are very much involved in the implementation of the ICHRAs. And where we're sitting now, we had the final rule that expanded the HRAs that was finalized this summer, but we're sitting right now on a proposed rule that goes into more detail on exactly how employers would put these ICHRAs into place with their employees. And so most of the conversation was about that proposed rule that came out on September 30th and will regulate how the ICHRAs operate for the first 6 months of the plan 2020 year, and then the comments that are going to go along with that proposed rule could alter the rules on how these are implemented moving forward after that time. But there are a lot of questions, and we met with the Trump administration officials along with one of our coalitions, the Partnership for Employer-Sponsored Coverage. And so most of our questions here and in this meeting were specific to employers and some of the questions that they're having around the implementation of the ICHRAs, things like employer reporting. I know that's no surprise to you all to hear. There are a lot of concerns because of the lack of guidance on how employer reporting should work for the ICHRAs, and also some concern that the vendors who facilitate the employer reporting also haven't gotten the guidance that they necessarily need for putting together the algorithms and programming to be able to assist employers. So there's a lot of concern about how employer reporting will work for when we're in calendar year 2021, but reporting for plan year 2020. And right now, the administration's answer was really kind of, well, we just have to wait and see and we'll make it through 2020. And because you're reporting in 2021, that's a problem for the future.
Marcy, I know one of the groups who was there were the retailers who were very busy over the holidays. And so a lot of plans in the retail universe tend to have June 1st or July 1st start dates. Could you explain a little bit about what the administration said of how HRAs would work for plans that are not calendar year?
There was a lot of conversation about this, and it was really interesting to hear from the different employers how this would affect their employees and their businesses. And so as Chris just pointed out, one of them was the retailers. And for them, the end of the year is very busy with the holidays. And so for them, being on a calendar year plan can be very challenging because their employees are then faced with the timing and the administrative burden and time it takes to actually sign up their employees for open enrollment at the end of a year. And so most of them have non-calendar year plans. The big question here was, because the retailers are often seen as a really great group, a group that's sort of ripe, so to speak, for the ICHRAs, the big problem is if they go to the ICHRA plan model, their HRA could be on a non-calendar year plan if that's what the employer is offering as their HRA coverage. But once they enroll in the individual plan, if they're on the exchange or any individual plan, they all run on the calendar year. So the first year that they enroll, if it's a non-calendar year plan, they have a special enrollment period because they're going into a newly created ICRA. But after that, they're going to be roped into a January 1 renewal date, which then, once again, if we're focusing on the retailers in the example Chris gave, will force those folks into a calendar year plan that isn't as convenient for them because as an employee, it's their busy time of year going through holiday retail. And as an employer, you really want your folks on the floor selling and not in the back room trying to decide what insurance to enroll with. So the administration is looking into this to see if there are ways that there can be any flexibility. But for right now, it seems as though if retailers or other groups go to this model, those that have this issue with end of year productivity and needing to have their employees working and not, like I said, in the back room determining what health plan to choose, this is going to be a big challenge for them.
One of the things the employers were also very confused in the room about are the different types of HRAs that are under this rule and what they can be used for. It seemed to be a lot of confusion just understanding the definition between the two of them. Could you go a little bit into that?
Sure. So with the final rule that we had that came out this summer, there are the individual HRAs and the accepted benefits HRAs. And so some of the confusion was from the employers who, again, their number one item of business is not health insurance, right? We all know that. That's not necessarily an employer's number one thing. And so for them, there are a lot of questions about what is an accepted benefit HRA? And with the limits on how much can go into an accepted benefits HRA, how those funds can be used. And because an accepted benefits HRA is set up for things like dental or vision, or one example that was discussed is having it for a specific type of cancer treatment. And normally the accepted benefit HRA is set up just for that one benefit. And so there was a lot of discussion about how many accepted benefit HRAs could function, and then also then looking and comparing that to the individual HRA, which is kind of the more traditional HRA used for health insurance, major medical health insurance coverage. Questions then on that surfaced around not adding those accepted benefits, but for the individual HRAs, is that something that can also be extended to be used by a spouse or dependents? And because it is an individual HRA, it's not something that can be done that way.
Marcy, did DOL provide any clarity around the amount or level of assistance that an employer can provide without crossing the line in for ERISA plans and being a bona fide plan?
John, there's a lot of concern about this on a number of levels because there is going to be heavy employer involvement to try to get these employees enrolled in ICRAs if that's the model that the employer chooses to go down. And so from a number of different fronts, there were questions to the administration about how much employer involvement can there be before we're triggering either the endorsement rules that prohibit an employer from endorsing any type of carrier or third party that's involved in the enrollment and process of getting into the HRA, but also if they are the level of involvement that the employers have for the distribution of this model before it triggers, like John mentioned, being an ERISA plan, actually being a true employer plan, if the employer is truly manipulating and encouraging enrollment in certain plans on the ICRAs and other pieces. And so the administration didn't have a clear response on this. I think it's something that we need to continue to raise in our comments and also in the future meetings that we'll have with them, because these will be ongoing as we move towards the 2020 plan year. And then as we kind of live through the first few months of the ICRA plans and see whether the administration feels like more guidance should be released on this, which I think we would like to see in that specific area, John.
House Democrats have once again delayed their planned vote on Speaker Nancy Pelosi's prescription drug plan and will not be considering it until at least December. What is the cause for this delay, and how does it change its prospects for a broader bipartisan package with the Senate?
So the official reason for delay is that there is not a score back from CBO. And while that may be true, I think there's some other things that we can take a look at in this conversation.
And before you go on, I just want to point out, it may be confusing to some listeners because there was a score from CBO, but it doesn't include the new amendments that are being considered here.
So we are waiting for that official score, and it apparently will take a couple more weeks. But I think there's some other things that we need to take a look at here. I think one dynamic is, while we do not expect any Republicans at this point to be voting for the House Pelosi package, they do need to obviously hold all the Democrats together. And the Democratic Party is very splintered along ideological differences. And the Progressive Caucus, the left of the party, has been trying to make the plan more punitive on pharma, heavier on the government's ability to negotiate and negotiate more drugs. While the more moderate to conservative side, including the New Democrats and the Blue Dogs, haven't been very publicly concerned about the effect on innovation and would not want to see the bill become any more punitive on the pharmaceutical industry because of the effect on innovation and the effect on price negotiations in general becoming typical for the federal government. So those sorts of two wings are continuing to fight things out before the bill goes onto the floor itself. Finally, I think there's a certain communications aspect here to particularly look at, and that is the fact that this particular month, all the news coming out of Washington is very impeachment heavy. And so I think there is a conscious decision that it is very hard to communicate about prescription drugs when the only topic that is making it into the media right now is around impeachment.
Yeah, it was really disappointing to hear that this has been delayed, especially after so many committees on the House side over the past couple of weeks had had hearings and markups and had voted favorably on it. And now we're once again in that holding pattern. So we'll keep you all up to date as to what we hear on the progress.
Along the same lines, the Senate has not really completed their work either, and their package is far different than the House version. So I think that, as I said last week, I still think that this whole prescription drug issue spills into 2020.
Yeah, I think it's unlikely the Senate takes the time to actually pass a prescription drug bill. It's more likely that whatever the House passes, they begin to negotiate with the Senate Finance Committee, and so that they're not negotiating off of a bill that's come out of the Senate, but out of the product that's come out of the committee, and see if they can find some common ground between the two. I also think on the House side, that score is something that is up to a lot of debate of what do you do, since it seems to be scoring savings, what do you do with those savings? We've seen this week a letter by more moderate to conservative Democrats going around that those money should be used for further delay of the HIT tax and other taxes such as the Cadillac tax and medical device tax. And so they're pushing for those savings to be used for that in any drug bill as it goes through Congress.
Senate Republicans have indicated that the president supports their efforts to implement Part D inflation caps, which have historically been opposed by Republicans as a gateway to government price controls on healthcare. With President Trump and Nancy Pelosi in agreement, what is the likelihood that these inflation caps will get enacted?
So Senate Republicans are treading very lightly, I think, to see what the president does. And this notion that the speaker and the president agree on something until it's put on paper, and I think until the air is cleared about impeachment, I don't think that we're going to have really any clarity on this issue. And it's just as well that the whole notion about prescription drugs and such is kicked to next year, because I don't think that this will be resolved in the near term.
And we're always careful whenever any type of proposal gets close to government price controls on healthcare. As we've talked about before on the podcast, we want to make sure that there is a free market approach and that we don't get into overly burdensome regulations. And that's also just a point of view to make sure that those types of restrictions aren't put back on to us and the agent and broker community.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting position that President Trump takes on this versus historically the Republican Party or conservative positions. And so it does change the discussion around prescription drugs or Part D, because you have not had a president who wanted to be as aggressive of this, particularly not one who comes from the Republican Party.
Yeah, privately, I've heard from Republican senators that they're not big fans. So until they actually see something. The devil's in the details, as we always say. And until we actually see legislative language, no one is going to come out and express a view on this.
Looking to the states, last week Georgia announced that it will be requesting an expanded ACA waiver to completely overhaul the state's individual market and bypass certain ACA protections. And rather than using an insurance exchange, consumers would purchase coverage directly through insurers or brokers. How would this concept work, and does it comply with the law's requirements?
So the timing of the application is purposeful. Last week, we had Congress voting on whether to overturn the ruling from the Trump administration to loosen up some of the guardrails for the restrictions on 1332 waivers. And Congress, in the end, supported what the Trump administration did. And so this application goes along with those new requirements that loosen those restrictions. And Georgia, what it's trying to do is establish its own subsidy structure to allow for the subsidization of plans that do not comply with the ACA requirements and to put enrollment caps in place if subsidy costs exceed federal and state funds. So what they're going to do, and this is kind of where we see a lot of discussion about their proposal, about how it's structured. I think we're going to see a lot of comments coming in, because when a 1332 waiver application is put in place, it is open to public comment. And here they're trying to use the funds that the state would have gotten, that insured folks in Georgia would have gotten through federal subsidies, to use it almost as a block grant to go to Georgia that they can then use in their own creation of their health insurance market, because they would eliminate healthcare.gov and transition to an individual market that's an entirely new model funded through this federal pass-through along with some specific state general revenue. And so they would use the funds coming through the federal government, like I said, kind of as a block grant, and pass it on through the state in a form of state subsidies. They believe that this process, which they would like to see managed by private entities like web brokers and insurers and using agents and brokers to facilitate this enrollment, they believe that decentralizing enrollment, so shifting it away from healthcare.gov and putting it towards these private entities, would promote competition, improve customer service, and drive enrollment.
Yeah, so, they have real market disparities within their own state in terms of pricing, where they have some counties, it's, you know, $600 a year, and it's twice that, $1,200 in other areas, and $1,000 in yet other areas. So it's a way to sort of smooth out their market.
And the excitement about this proposal is not just because of the way that they're using the funding and the fact that they're going away from a public entity for enrollment. It's also that when they do use the subsidization structure through the state, that they would allow those funds to go towards new state-specific subsidies that would expand the type of products that those individuals could receive subsidies for, to include non-QHP, so non-qualified health plans that do not comply with the ACA. So that's going to be another big piece when this goes over to CMS for approval, is going to be whether CMS is going to now interpret those new guardrails that the Trump administration came out with, and as to whether they can actually offer these funds towards plans that do not comply with the ACA. So that is going to be something that's going to keep us on the edge of our seats watching this as it goes through the approval process.
If it is accepted by Washington, other states, I can just see, will be getting in line to do the same thing.
Oh, definitely, especially when we see in other states variants in their markets of Christian cost-sharing ministries, AHPs, and other pieces, short-term limited duration plans, the differences across the states and how long someone can be enrolled in those types of plans. Here, if Georgia gets approval to be able to extend their state subsidies that are partially funded through the federal government, when you really think about it, if they're able to get this approval, other states that have plans like those that are seemingly more attractive to some individuals and consumers, I think may try to follow follow suit. But there is concern about how this could affect ACA market plans, how it could affect major medical plans, if there is a shift over to non-QHP plans. So these are all factors that are going to be considered in the approval of this application.
Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren released her plan last week to pay for Medicare for All by transferring existing premium contributions from employer-sponsored coverage to cover all Americans. How would this work, particularly for those employers who offer generous benefits, as well as those who offer none at all? And how likely is it that this proposal could be enacted if Warren is elected?
Well, I think the pay-fors are actually far greater than just that. But we've always said, haven't we, that there would be a maintenance of effort requirement of employers if we went to a single-payer system. And this is just one component of that. But to your point, I mean, she is trying to steer clear of hitting middle-class individuals with a tax increase and, you know, hitting the usual, the very, very rich and others.
As you pointed out, the plan actually has several taxes beyond just taking essentially the employer exclusion and moving it across over to be used for a single payer. I do think not all employers are paying the same amount for health insurance. This is particularly what the unions point out in this particular scenario, because the unions are more generous with health insurance than many employers. And so I think that's partly why you find a lot of pushback from unions when they're looking at the issue of single payer and this fear that what they end up will not be as generous as what they have today. Furthermore, will it not be as generous as they have today, and will they be paying more in taxes than they would be paying for in healthcare? Elizabeth Warren tries to make it sound like, well, you're just going to take all the money that you give to the insurance carriers. Instead of giving it to the insurance carriers, you're going to be giving it to the government now, and all the deductibles, co-pays, and everything else goes away. Well, it's not actually that simple. It's not the dollars are not one-to-one. If we just take all the admin cost from health insurance carriers, that does not cover all the rest of this. And so she does lay out several different taxes in there. And then I even question, and I think some of the counter studies that are coming out of this, is does she have enough revenue in her plan to actually cover the cost of running a single-payer healthcare plan? I'm very skeptical that it does.
Well, and even think about just the baseline starting off. Like Chris mentioned, it looks at taxing employers on, I think it's what, 98% of what they're currently paying on healthcare for health insurance costs. And that's something that right now employers can shop around for. So similar employers with a similar makeup may be paying very, very different costs right now. And if they're both taxed at 98%, that could possibly be something that isn't being levied in those first couple of years as something that's really equal and across the board for those employers that may have shopped better than others. And so it seems like an odd way to try to do that measurement off the top. It's also something that I think, and her plan is different than the Sanders plan, but when we're talking about Medicare for All, oftentimes part of that conversation comes up about, well, if employers aren't paying as much for health insurance and you as a consumer are paying as much in your deductibles and copays and those sorts of things, that there's a possibility of seeing an income swing up. And we all know that that is kind of a falsehood when we talk about it. And so I think the way that it's discussed in the Warren plan of putting those funds, as Chris said, not towards the employer, but towards the federal government, I think makes that argument or misconception that possibly incomes would rise because of this. It really makes a clear distinction that that's not something that's going to happen.
This is the same argument they made that the Cadillac tax is somehow going to make us all get all these great salary increases. I think it doesn't work there in reality, and it's not going to work here in reality.
And then part of Dan's question was, how likely is it that this proposal could be enacted if Warren is elected? And I think we're a long way from there, even if Warren is elected. I like to say that I don't think Medicare for All in a pure iteration where it's not just a public option, I don't think that Medicare for All is going to happen until I'm possibly on Medicare and possibly beyond that. And so I think even with this proposal, and even if Warren is elected, I don't think that we're going to see this proposal enacted in that 4-year time period. in that four-year hypothetical time period.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. I was going to say that, you know, it took President Obama a good chunk of his first term and spent a lot of his political capital on getting what the ACA done. And this is even a bigger lift.
This is way more radical.
The impacts are just, right? It has so many economic repercussions and changes in tax codes and so forth. You know, and she has other priorities too. And I don't know how you could fit those in if this were to be her number one priority.
And I think you make a good point about priorities. You find with presidents, they tend to be able to get one or two big things. President Trump, his big accomplishment with the tax cuts. President Obama was the ACA. Are you going to be able to, if you're Elizabeth Warren, get this, but also what she wants to do on banking, what she wants to do on the environment, what
education reform.
Education. No president, regardless of if they control the White House, the Senate, and the House, as both Obama and Trump had in their first terms, gets all of them. I even find it highly likely that even if there is a President Warren administration, that the Senate would remain in Republican hands. And so that makes big items like this even less likely to happen. But even if, for some reason, the Senate were to flip, you know, in our lifetimes, I expect both the Democratic and Republican parties to control all the branches of government multiple times. But even if it goes one of those ways, it is still a Herculean task to get done such big ideas and to achieve all of them.
And imagine in a four-year term, there's a midterm election. Mm-hmm. So people have to be really happy about what you're doing those first 2 years to get reelected and to maintain that control for the next two.
And so regardless what we see with the Warren proposal, this is a great reason if you're interested in single payer or Medicare for all to tune in to this month's live from NEHU on November 14th at noon when NEHU CEO Janet Trotwine will be hosting a discussion on Medicare for all.
It's now time for the NEHU Healthcare Happy Hours Toast of the Week. What are we toasting to this week?
So Monday is Veterans Day, and as a veteran, I want to toast to my fellow veterans.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for this week's installment of the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts, or to join as a member of NAHU, visit NAHU.org.